Hey, I'm Brian Stelter, host of Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. This week, I'm talking with author Dave Cullen about the 25th anniversary of the Columbine Massacre.
Well, I think the anniversaries are a good time to just stop and take stock, because normally we're seeing things in isolation. And 10 years out, 20 years out, especially 25 years out, it's really good to step back and see, like, okay, what has this wrought?
Where are we now? What's changed? What hasn't? What should? Join me, Brian Stelter, on Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
A heads up for listeners. Throughout this podcast, you'll hear original audio from 9/11, plus recreations of the day. We feel it is important for you to hear, but it can also be disturbing. The story of American Airlines Flight 77, the hijacked plane that struck the Pentagon, is often overlooked in our retelling of September 11th. It's a touchy subject for witnesses and survivors. I've often heard that they feel left out of memorials and retrospectives of 9/11 that focus on the iconic, more visible attack on the World Trade Center, or on the heroism of the passengers and crew of United Airlines Flight 93. Flight 77's story shares some of the same details as the other hijacked planes. After the plane departed Dulles International Airport, a group of hijackers stormed the cockpit using box cutters as weapons. Just before 9 a.m., they had control of the plane and turned it to the south. It looked originally like they were heading for the White House. Air traffic controller Danielle O'Brien watched from her radar in Dulles. She saw the plane fly towards Washington. O'Brien spoke to ABC's Brian Ross a few weeks later.
How far out was that plane?
Between 12 and 14 miles. John, our supervisor, relayed verbatim. Okay, he's 12 miles west. He's moving very fast, eastbound. Okay, guys, where is he now? 11 miles west. And it was just a countdown. 10 miles west. 9 miles west.
As the plane approached the White House at 9:34, air traffic controllers desperately tried to get word to the Secret Service. O'Brien watched the plane on her radar. It now looked to be 7 miles away. Capitol Police told people to run and find shelter. The plane was closing in. 6 miles.
5, 4. And I had it in my mouth to say 3. And all of a sudden, the plane turned away. In the room, it was almost a sense of relief. And we sat back in our chairs and breathed. For just a second, he continued the right-hand turn, made a 360-degree maneuver.
A big loop?
Correct. And we're telling the supervisor he's turning back in. He's turning back eastbound. We lost radar contact with that aircraft. And we waited, and we waited. And your heart's just beating out of your chest.
Just across the Potomac from Washington, D.C., Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld was having breakfast with members of the U.S. House at the Pentagon. He was in the middle of pitching them on increasing the defense budget when he got a note. Here's Rumsfeld, who passed away in 2021, speaking earlier to the Smithsonian.
And Admiral Giambastiani came in, my senior military assistant, with a note indicating that a plane had crashed into one of the World Trade Center towers. The mood in the building and in the room changed dramatically. And it was shortly thereafter that we felt that the Pentagon had been hit. It felt like a bomb. The smoke began to fill up in the building. And so we went downstairs, outside, and around the building.
The common shorthand we use for Flight 77, that the plane hit Washington, is incorrect. The Pentagon is in nearby Arlington, Virginia, and it was the first responders from the Arlington County Fire Department, Arlington County Police, and the Pentagon Police who responded to the crash that morning. In the years after, nearly 10% of the Arlington County Fire Department would retire prematurely with post-traumatic stress from September 11th. But this isn't just the story of how that plane hit the Pentagon. I want to tell you about what happened afterward in the chain of command. In the wake of the crash, the rest of the government had lost contact with Don Rumsfeld. The silence left many to assume he was missing, perhaps injured, perhaps even dead. September 11th, 2001 was the nightmare scenario that many of us thought our government was singularly prepared for, a direct attack on our nation. The defenses of the richest country on earth had spent decades and trillions of dollars to prepare for exactly this type of moment, to stop an incoming threat. While the nation was under attack, the defense secretary was MIA. The president was aboard Air Force One, cut off from the rest of the leadership. Military commanders were scattered all over the world. High-ranking members of the White House staff were scrambling to take shelter or flee. The country seemed defenseless. Then, less than an hour after the Pentagon was struck, the fighter pilots who scrambled into the air over D.C. got an unprecedented order. Shoot down any hijacked commercial airliners. But records from the day are unclear on who approved that order and when. Officially, the only people who would be authorized to give an order like that are in what's called the National Command Authority, a military operational chain of command that runs down from the president to the Secretary of Defense down to so-called combatant commanders. On 9/11, it seems the person who relayed that order wasn't in that group. Instead, it was Vice President Dick Cheney. I'm Garrett Graff, a journalist, historian, and author of the New York Times bestselling History of 9/11, The Only Plane in the Sky. I've spent most of the last two decades studying and reporting on that tragedy and how it changed our world. But as we near the 20th anniversary of the attacks, it's clear that many people still don't know the full story of 9/11. From Long Lead and Goat Rodeo, this is Long Shadow, a podcast about the enduring mysteries and lingering questions of 9/11. Episode 3, How a Surprise Attack, a Capital Under Siege, and a Dissolving Chain of Command led to one of the day's darkest decisions. The U.S. military was actually primed and ready to stop an attack that morning, just not the one that it actually faced. Many in the U.S. military weren't thinking about terrorism at all. Instead, we were prepared to fight the Cold War. Literally. That day, the U.S. military was engaged in something called Global Guardian, a huge annual training exercise to prepare our armed forces for a Russian attack. The planes that they had been focused on that morning? Russian bombers off the coast of Alaska, engaged in their own training exercises. The morning of 9/11, the U.S. had already put submarines out to sea and loaded nuclear weapons onto B-52 bombers at bases around the country and spooled up its ICBMs. But none of that would stop 19 men armed with box cutters. Jamie Gorelick is a former deputy attorney general who would later go on to serve on the 9/11 commission.
The notion that we were still in a mindset in 2001 in which the enemy we were planning for and preparing against was Russia was so divorced from the reality of what our intelligence communities knew to be the threat that it was astounding.
Part of the Global Guardian exercise involved responding to different training scenarios. A hypothetical attack would be proposed, and the crew would read and react. But strange reports began trickling into commands as morning briefings wrapped up around the country. Lieutenant General Tom Keck was at Barksdale Air Force Base in Shreveport, Louisiana, and he remembers a captain telling him an aircraft had hit the World Trade Center. "I started to correct him," Keck recalled when I interviewed him in 2016. "When you have an exercise input," he told the officer, "you have to start by saying, 'I have an exercise input.' That way, it doesn't get confused with the real world," he told me. Then the officer pointed to the TV screens in the command center where Keck saw smoke pouring out of the World Trade Center.
"There's a huge gaping hole in one of the towers of the World Trade Center."
This, Keck realized, was the real world.
"Oh, there's another one. Another plane just hit. Right? Oh, my God. Another plane has just hit. It hit another building."
Keck ordered the exercise abandoned and had the base's threat level increased. A few minutes later, he was handed a pistol. According to regulations, he had to wear it when the base was under attack. Similar confusion rippled across the U.S. military coast to coast, and the truth was that the U.S. had almost nothing it could call upon to intercept or stop the terrorists. At the peak of the Cold War, the U.S. had scores of fighters ready across the country to stop a Soviet attack by air. But that morning, the military had just 7 pairs of armed fighters protecting the entire country. Just 7. And only 2 sets of those aircraft were actually in the Northeast. There were 2 Alert jets at Otis Air Force Base on Cape Cod, and 2 more at Langley Air Force Base in Virginia. NORAD, the military command that protects North America, scrambled all of them into the air. And then the question became, what else do we have?
When you talk to the pilots who scrambled, and you ask them, what were you looking for when you were up in the sky? And they said, we didn't know. We assumed it was the Russians. Both Otis pilots and the Langley pilots went in the wrong direction because they had no idea why they were being scrambled.
From Andrews Air Force Base, just miles away from the Pentagon, First Lieutenant Heather Penny watched the second hijacked plane hit the World Trade Center. Her military call sign was Lucky. Lucky Penny. She was with the D.C. Air National Guard. Here's Penny speaking to Steve Scully on C-SPAN in 2011.
I was a brand new first lieutenant. I had just gotten to the fighter squadron in January of 2001. I was also a brand new wingman, having just graduated from the F-16 basic course. And so I was still a young fighter pilot learning my trade.
Penny was supposed to be training that day, but she realized her team might be called into the air over the Capitol soon. She says that they were ready to take off, but they never heard from the FAA or regional air defenses, who were tasked with scrambling our nation's fighters. In fact, NORAD didn't even know they were there.
So there was a lot of confusion. As a young wingman, I mean, really kind of the most that I could do was stand there and be ready to be tasked. As I watched my leadership in a very creative and ad hoc way, try to reach up through their chain of command to be able to get authority to launch.
Penny and her colleagues desperately tried to reach someone who could send them into the sky, but their quest ran into one of the first major problems for that day. Who was in charge of the U.S. government? By the time the third plane hit the Pentagon, President George W. Bush was leaving an elementary school in Florida. Then he was rushed to Air Force One to be safely hidden in the sky. Back in 2001, the president's plane wasn't the technological marvel it is today. The televisions on board could barely get a signal, and phones were limited. There was no email. The high-tech equipment the president's staff carried? Pagers. President Bush spent much of September 11th flying across the country, hopping between military bases to wait out the worst of the attacks until the Secret Service and the military could be assured that there were no more missiles in the sky. ABC News' Ann Compton was on the plane. She recalled the day in a 2015 forum.
At that point, there was no way for George W. Bush to go back to Washington. I know he took a lot of flack for not going back, but you can't take Air Force One into a city where a major building like the Pentagon is in flames.
In Arlington, near D.C., Don Rumsfeld, the second person in the military chain of command after the president, hadn't died or been injured at the Pentagon like many suspected. Instead, he had rushed outside to the crash site.
And it was a terrible crash site with flame and smoke and bodies, pieces of metal spread all across the grass outside of the Pentagon.
Under the protocols of a Cold War-era contingency plan, Rumsfeld should have been evacuated, pooled with the rest of the command staff, and put in contact with the president. But that's not how the morning unfolded. Torn between his professional duty and the human carnage in front of him, Rumsfeld helped carry stretchers with wounded personnel out of the impact zone. Only after about 45 minutes did he return to the Pentagon's command center to help manage the crisis. That series of choices would long endear him to the military and political observers. They cited his instincts as a badge of honor upon his death in June 2021. But the fact remains that Secretary Rumsfeld put himself in tremendous danger and out of communication during the worst terrorist attack on U.S. soil. It was precisely the right thing to do as a human and as a leader, and exactly the wrong thing to do as the nation's Secretary of Defense. Less than 5 miles away in the halls of the White House, staffers were told to evacuate immediately. "Take off your shoes and run," officers shouted to the staff. Matt Waxman was only a few weeks into his new job as executive assistant to National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice. They were in a meeting at the White House when the first two planes hit.
But there was all kinds of information flying around the Situation Room, and some people were literally running into each other, bumping into each other.
Upstairs, Vice President Cheney watched the towers get hit from a TV in the White House. Then the Secret Service told him that a hijacked plane was just miles away and flying low. Deputy White House Chief of Staff Josh Bolton was the highest-ranking member of the president's staff present that day. He went to Cheney's office after the second tower was struck. Here he is speaking to C-SPAN in 2013.
"We went upstairs to the vice president's office. While we were there in the vice president's office, a large Secret Service agent whose face I can still remember, he had kind of a shaved head, big guy, came in and said to the vice president, 'We have to leave now.' And the vice president was kind of reluctant. I mean, he was, you know, he's still having a conversation and stuff, and he's not interested in fleeing his office. And so the Secret Service agent came around behind him and got him in a bear hug and picked him up off the ground and started running with him, with the vice president's legs sort of helping out along the way. And they disappeared off on the way to what has now been publicly disclosed as the bunker."
That secure bunker underneath the East Wing had never been used before for an emergency. And the scene was already chaotic, according to Zero Fail, a new book out this year by The Washington Post's Carol Lenig. She reports that the situation was so unimaginable that Cheney's Secret Service detail didn't even have the keys to get into the bunker that morning. Instead, they were still crouched outside the protective door when Flight 77 hit the Pentagon at 9:37 and entered the Presidential Emergency Operations Center only shortly thereafter. Matt Waxman later got word that Condoleezza Rice wanted him in the bunker too.
You know, we could hear fighter jets overhead as the senior staff and senior leaders were evacuated into the bunker. You know, I was still so new at the NSC that at the time I still had a temporary badge. So I remember having to basically talk my way into the bunker, because I wasn't on any sort of list of officials who were supposed to have access. So it actually took me a little while to, like I said, to talk my way in.
Vice President Cheney at this point had received a status report. Here he is speaking to the Smithsonian on the 10th anniversary of the attacks.
"We had a list of 6 aircraft that had been hijacked with the tail numbers. And of course, there were only 4 that had been hijacked, but for a long time there, we thought there were 6. And then we received reports about the same time that there had been a car bomb set off at the State Department, another one on Capitol Hill. There were all of these reports coming in about attacks and threats. Many of which, of course, were inaccurate. There was a story about a plane headed for the president's ranch in Crawford, another one going to fly into Camp David. Part of it was just the fog of war. It just simply wasn't true, but you had to be able to operate in spite of that. It's one of those days where you have to be able to sort through what's important and what you can deal with, what you can act upon, where you can have an impact, and not worry about the rest of it."
Those first confusing reports on September 11th kicked off a mad scramble inside the government to muster a response. This confusion, this chaos, is a critical point to understand about the U.S. government's response that morning. We now know that there were just four planes, but even well into the early afternoon of 9/11, officials believed that there were more hijacked planes in the sky. Skyscrapers were evacuated in Chicago, Boston, Los Angeles. Disney World shut down in Florida. People everywhere were afraid. They didn't know what came next. President Bush was in and out of communication, his plane circling high in the sky over the Gulf of Mexico. Defense Secretary Rumsfeld was off providing crash site triage. And the military's top uniformed leader, General Hugh Shelton, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, was on a flight headed for Europe. Secretary of State Colin Powell, he was in South America. All that meant, officially or not, Vice President Cheney thought he was leading the nation's defense on 9/11. And in some ways, Dick Cheney's entire political career had been building to this moment. Here he is at the Nixon Library describing why George W. Bush wanted him as his running mate in 2000.
He, in fact, wanted somebody who had the kind of experiences I had as Secretary of Defense, etc. And he was very serious about allowing me to be an integral part of the team, to get involved in whatever I wanted to get involved in, and to bring to the job the opportunity to have a significant impact. And of course, at that stage, neither one of us anticipated what was going to happen on 9/11.
Dick Cheney had been involved in emergency government plans for decades. He first served as President Gerald Ford's chief of staff, and then as George H.W. Bush's defense secretary.
I've heard his thinking on arms control, Central American policy, strategic defense posture. Dick Cheney is a trusted friend and advisor, and I'm convinced that he's going to be a great leader of our nation's military forces.
And in the 1980s, as a congressman, Cheney had taken part in one of the most secret government projects ever, the Presidential Successor Support System, or PS3. It pre-designated former top officials as the emergency presidential chiefs of staff in waiting, men who would take charge following a surprise nuclear attack on the United States. It meant that non-active officials would be whisked to bunkers around the country at the start or warning of hostilities to come. The policy would, during a catastrophe, create a shadow government in waiting that could keep the nation's essential functions running, even in the worst nuclear attack. Ultimately, these continuity of government plans wouldn't be used during the Cold War, but they were put into effect on September 11th, when Dick Cheney was rushed beneath the White House. 9/11 Commission member Jamie Gorelick.
There was no convening of the people who could have helped the United States respond until well after the event was over. What is supposed to happen is that the people in charge of the command center are supposed to go get the secretary and all of the relevant other personnel and bring them together in one room, establish connectivity with the White House and the president, and act in a cohesive way. Our literal response had such a time lag in it as to render it useless.
Those continuity of government plans should have put Don Rumsfeld on the phone to help coordinate the country's defense. But since he was hauling stretchers around the Pentagon crash site, Cheney felt he was in charge, rightly or not. As the attacks unfolded, the vice president struggled to follow the morning's developments while cordoned off in the White House bunker. His team had trouble getting accurate info or connecting with the Pentagon or other government officials outside. Matt Waxman worked in the White House on the National Security Council.
I remember that the signal to the TVs on the wall, for example, kept going down, that phone lines would continually drop during that day. Like I said, I remember sometimes just holding a secure phone line to my ear, just holding it open. to make sure that some of the senior leadership in the bunker could communicate with their U.S. government counterparts who were spread out around a number of different sites. Besides that, there were too many people in the bunker, an unexpectedly large number who were down there. At one point, I heard someone say that the carbon dioxide levels were too high and they had to start pumping in more oxygen.
In fact, the technology at the bunker proved so antiquated that they couldn't listen to the TV and talk on the government's conference call at the same time. They had to turn the volume up on one instead of another. At 9:59 a.m., the South Tower collapsed in a horrifying cloud of dust.
It folded down on itself, and it is not there anymore.
The whole side has collapsed?
The whole building has collapsed.
The whole building has collapsed?
The building has collapsed.
That's the Southern Tower.
This is the moment that's been the subject of so much debate. Dick Cheney has long insisted the next few minutes went something like this. Using a secure line from the bunker, he was able to get a call through to President Bush on Air Force One. Cheney told him that they had intel that hijacked planes were inbound to Washington. He said President Bush should give the order to shoot them down. The president agreed, and Cheney then passed along that command. Here's Bush's chief of staff, Andy Card.
And I was sitting directly across from the president at his desk on Air Force One when this conversation is taking place. And it was a remarkable experience for me because the president was the only person I knew that could be asked that question who had empathy. He had been an Air National Guard fighter pilot. And he said, I can't imagine, these are roughly the words he said, I can't imagine being a 22-year-old pilot being told to shoot down a commercial jetliner.
The Pentagon's main link to the White House bunker that morning went through Navy Commander Anthony Barnes. He was part of that top-secret presidential continuity of government program and was on duty that morning staffing the bunker, as it is 24/7, for a moment just like this. Barnes had never spoken publicly about that morning until I interviewed him in 2018. They were asking for permission to shoot down an identified hijacked commercial aircraft, Barnes told me. I asked the vice president that question, and he answered it in the affirmative. I asked again to be sure, "Sir, I am confirming that you have given permission." I wanted to make sure that there was no mistake whatsoever about what was being asked. Then Cheney answered without hesitation in the affirmative. He apparently didn't think twice. Scooter Libby, his chief of staff, recalled the vice president made the decision, quote, in about the time it takes a batter to decide to swing. After carrying wounded personnel from the crash site, Secretary Rumsfeld returned to the Pentagon's smoke-filled nerve center around 10:30 a.m. He spoke to the vice president by phone shortly thereafter. According to a transcript of the call, here's how it went. Cheney told the defense secretary, quote, there's been at least three instances here where we've had reports of aircraft approaching Washington. Pursuant to the president's instructions, I gave authorization for them to be taken out. Rumsfeld didn't respond. Cheney broke the silence and asked, hello? Finally, Rumsfeld replied, yes, I understand. So we've got a couple aircraft up there that have those instructions at this present time? Cheney answered, that is correct, and it's my understanding they've already taken a couple of aircraft out. Vice President Cheney's assumption that morning was wrong. The downed aircraft he was referring to, United Airlines Flight 93, had crashed at 10:03, more than 30 minutes earlier. 9/11 Commissioner Jamie Gorelick.
One of the most shocking aspects of the 9/11 Commission report and process was that we had sessions with very senior and responsible people within the Air Force who told us that they were tracking Flight 93, for example, and had it not crashed in Pennsylvania, would have been in a position to take it out. That turned out to be entirely false.
In the subsequent years, Bush and Cheney both have repeated that same timeline of that order. The vice president spoke to the president from the bunker, advised him to approve the shoot-down order, and President Bush did so. But there's little proof to support it. In fact, the closer you look, the more it appears that Vice President Cheney gave the order unilaterally. So did the president approve it only after Cheney had already ordered the fighters into battle? According to the 9/11 Commission, Deputy Chief of Staff Joshua Bolten was present when Cheney gave the authorization to Barnes to shoot down the planes. They found that Bolten watched the exchange, and after what he called a quiet moment, he suggested the vice president call the president to confirm the engagement order. The 9/11 Commission report reads, quote, "He wanted to make sure the president was told that the vice president had executed the order. He said he had not heard any prior discussion on the subject with the president." In other words, according to the 9/11 Commission, Cheney gave the order. Then Bolten recommended that the vice president confirm it with the president. There's some supporting evidence for Cheney's version from National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice. She told the 9/11 Commission that when she entered the bunker, she heard Cheney on the phone with the president. Rice said she remembered hearing the vice president say, quote, "Sir, the combat air patrols are up. Sir, they're going to want to know what to do." But if that call did take place, there's no record of it. Commission member Jamie Gorelick investigated the timeline of the shootdown.
When we looked at the call records to President Bush, who was in the air himself or on the ground at the school, we did not see evidence of a call in the relevant time period. The vice president said he had made that call, but we didn't see confirming records. If the president had been incommunicado in some way, that would have been understandable that the vice president would have tried to do what he could to protect the country. But if he could have reached the president and decided on his own without that conversation to take action, that would have been troubling.
It's the most consequential order of the entire morning, perhaps one of the most important in American history. An order that, as George W. Bush himself realized that morning, would be unthinkable to pass along to a young fighter pilot. The order to fire a weapon of war into the side of a civilian airplane. And yet, as best as we can tell, it's an order that came from someone who didn't have the authority to give it. That's the reason we're talking about it on this podcast. The vice president is not in the military chain of command. That means, legally speaking, he can't scramble the nation's fighters into battle. And he certainly didn't have the authority to make a decision that would kill American civilians. According to the standard protocols, that order could have only come from the president or the Secretary of Defense. Here's Vice President Cheney basically saying that himself when he spoke to Tim Russert on Meet the Press 5 days after September 11th.
So if the United States government became aware that a hijacked commercial airline was destined for the White House or the Capitol, we would take the plane down.
Yes, the president made the decision on my recommendation as well, wholeheartedly concurred in the decision he made, that if the plane would not divert, if they wouldn't pay any attention to instructions to move away from the city, as a last resort, our pilots were authorized to take them out. Now, people say, you know, that's a horrendous decision to make. Well, it is. You've got an airplane full of American citizens, civilians, captured by hostages, captured by terrorists, headed, and are you going to, in fact, shoot it down, obviously, and kill all those Americans on board? And you have to ask yourself, if we had had combat air patrol up over New York, and we'd had the opportunity to take out the two aircraft to hit the World Trade Center, would we have been justified in doing it? I think absolutely we would.
And that will be the policy of the United States in the future?
Well, the president will, I'm sure, make a decision if those circumstances arise again. It's a presidential-level decision, and the president made, I think, exactly the right call in this case. To say I wished we'd had combat air patrol up over New York.
At Andrews Air Force Base near Washington, the order ended up with Heather Lucky Penny. Her unit, the 113th Wing of the D.C. Air National Guard, in the end, never even got their orders from the military. Instead, apparently, they were ordered into the sky by the Secret Service, who relayed orders from an agent in the bunker along with the vice president. As Penny's squadron raced to respond to the new orders, their jets weren't outfitted with weapons. That morning, they were supposed to be training, not fighting. But they knew they had no time to spare. Here's Penny speaking to Steve Scully on C-SPAN in 2011.
Were you prepared for that? Were you prepared to shoot down a commercial passenger jet?
We wouldn't be shooting it down. We would be ramming the aircraft because we didn't have weapons on board to be able to shoot the airplane down. And so as we were putting on our flight gear in the life support shop, Sass looked at me and said, I'll ram the cockpit. And I had made the decision that I would take the tail off the aircraft. I mean, the people on Flight 93 were heroes, but they were going to die no matter what. And so my concern was, how do I minimize collateral damage on the ground?
Penny and her flight lead flew out over the Maryland countryside, but the plane she was looking for, United Airlines Flight 93, was nowhere to be seen. Later, when word reached the White House that it had crashed into a field, the vice president assumed his shoot-down order was behind it. But were U.S. fighter jets ever in a position to take down a hijacked plane? The answer is a clear no. Cheney's assumption that morning was wrong. United Airlines Flight 93, the last plane in the sky hijacked that day, crashed at 10:03, about 12 minutes before Cheney gave his order, sometime between 10:10 and 10:15, with or without presidential authorization. Had Flight 93 continued to Washington uninterrupted, it would have reached the Capitol or the White House sometime between 10:13 and 10:23. And according to the 9/11 Commission's reconstruction of that morning, the vice president's directive didn't reach the military until 10:31. The first fighters from Andrews didn't take off until 10:38. In other words, much too late. The simple fact is that from the moment that the first hijacking was reported on the morning of September 11th, the U.S. government did not take a single action that changed the outcome of the attacks. The world's most powerful military, that day, was powerless.
When I took off that day, we didn't know what would happen. We fully expected to intercept Flight 93 and to take it down. Reflecting on it, I didn't change history. I didn't keep the Pentagon from being hit. The experience of the moment and did we actually change the course of events were kind of two different things. So how you resolve those is, I don't know that you really do.
Next time on Long Shadow, hear how air traffic controllers shut down the nation's airspace with no warning and no playbook. They landed more than 4,000 planes in the hours after the attacks. But what if more planes were meant to be hijacked that day, and they never got off the ground?
That's right, a plane that was only minutes from being in the air on 9/11, a plane that some believe could have become a fifth missile.
That episode of Long Shadow will premiere next week, September 1st, with new episodes then following every Wednesday and Friday through 9/11. Long Shadow is a production from Goat Rodeo and Longlead. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts. Go ahead and rate the show and leave us a review. It helps spread the word. I'm your host, Garrett Graff. Long Shadow's lead producer is Max Johnston. John Patrick Pullen is the show's executive producer. The episode was written by me and Max. Story editing from Morgan Springer. Editorial support from Dan Eisner, Diana Albasha, and Owen O'Carroll. Senior producers at Goat Rodeo are Megan Nadolski and Ian Enright. Rebecca Seidel is managing producer. Music from Blue Dot Sessions and Ian Enright. Podcast artwork by Emily Crawford. Longlead's creative director is Natalie Matuszewski. And a thanks to ABC, CBS, NBC, PBS, C-SPAN, and the 9/11 Memorial and Museum for some of the archival audio you hear on the show.